From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. We've got a couple tough characters on the show today. They're pretty tough on screen and TV, and also display some real inner grit in life as well. First, Charlize Theron. She played a woman who rescues young women from the villain in the post-apocalyptic film Mad Max Fury Road, and she's currently playing a superhero in the new film The Old Guard. Also, Danny Trejo. He's made a career of playing menacing characters, including the TV series Breaking Bad and the film Machete. As a young man, Trejo was in and out of prison, once for armed robbery, and he struggled with addiction. A new documentary, Inmate Number One, The Rise of Danny Trejo, chronicles those years and how he was able to transform himself. Today's first guest, Charlize Theron, stars in the new Netflix movie The Old Guard, playing an immortal superhero soldier. It premiered last Friday. Charlize Theron has portrayed tough warriors before, in such films as Mad Max Fury Road and Aeon Flux, but her resume goes much deeper. In the film Bombshell, she played one of several women fighting against sexual harassment at Fox News. She both starred in and produced the movie Monster, playing real-life serial killer Eileen Wuornos, and won a Best Actress Oscar for it. Charlize Theron grew up on a farm in South Africa during the apartheid era. Less than 10 years after her first on-screen role, she won an Academy Award. Terry Gross spoke with Charlize Theron last year when Bombshell was released, and asked the actress about her own experiences with sexual harassment in Hollywood.
You've talked about in other interviews how your first audition ended up being with a sexual harasser. It was like you were told by, I think, like a modeling agency who knew that you wanted to act. They suggested you go on this audition. It was a Saturday evening that you were supposed to meet the producer or
director, yeah.
At his home, he opened the door and he was wearing pajamas and had been drinking. So this was before today's level of public awareness. This is before the Me Too movement. It was before you had any reason to expect that it would be not the harasser who faced consequences, but you, if you went public about it. So can you describe what it was like to have to react on the spot when you saw the position he was in his pajamas, and then instead of having you like read for your audition, he touched your knee? How do you know what to do in that moment?
You don't. You don't. And I think for people who have not experienced sexual harassment, it's a very difficult thing to wrap their head around. A woman yesterday, we were doing a press junket, and a female journalist said to me, but don't you always have the option of just saying no and leaving the room? And I think that is a mentality that a lot of people still have about sexual harassment, that somehow when you find yourself in that position, that very unfortunate position, that you are going to do everything right, you're going to say everything right, you're going to be the hero in that scene, and you're going to tell this guy exactly what a creep he is, and you're going to march off into the sunset. And that is just not the truth about a lot of these situations. And I've personally found myself, this happened in 94, I personally found myself in a situation where I wasn't even fully convinced that it was sexual harassment. And I don't think I really knew that until way later in my career. But what I did know was that I put a lot of blame on myself, in the sense that I was angry with myself that I didn't say all the right things, and that I didn't tell him to, you know, take a hike, and that I didn't do all of those things that we so want to believe we'll do in those situations. Instead, I very politely apologized, and then I was in my car driving away, and I just kept hitting the steering wheel. And I was really emotional about it because I couldn't understand where this behavior came from. I was raised with an incredibly strong mother figure, my mother, who, you know, I grew up watching her work in a business where women weren't allowed to work. I mean, she worked in road construction at a time when no women worked in road construction. And my whole life, all I saw was men coming into her office and having meetings with her. And so my impression of the world was that that was just what you did. And so nothing in my past made me feel like, well, then of course this is why I would apologize and why I would kind of react in this meek way with this guy and not say anything. I didn't know where that came from, and it took me a really long time to realize that that was a cultural influence, that it wasn't necessarily from how I was raised, but it was almost like instilled in me that that's just kind of what you did. You didn't rock the boat. This was somebody who was going to maybe give you a job. I was just starting out in the industry. I didn't really know the ins and outs. I literally was telling myself as I was driving there on a Saturday night at 9 o'clock, well, maybe that's how they do it in the movie industry. I don't know. I've never done this.
He's a busy man. Maybe his time is right. That's all the only time he has. So when you apologized to him, what did you say? Do you remember?
I don't even think it was like a specific apology, but I remember saying I'm sorry when I was trying to leave, and that I made it like the apology about I'm sorry that I have to leave because I was trying to remove myself from the room. And that in itself is just so unbelievably effed up. I you know, that is a mentality that we have to really change within our culture, within our girls. I had a very interesting experience with this man 8 years later, where he actually offered me a job. And he is a very well-known director. And 8 years later, I was found myself in a place in my career where I was actually getting offers, and he offered me a job. And I knew I wasn't going to take the job, but I took the meeting, because I felt like I finally had my opportunity. I wanted to have that moment that I didn't get to have with him. And his producer was in the meeting as well, and he introduced me to him. And he said, I want you to meet. I said, no, actually, we know each other. He said, oh, I didn't know that. I said, yeah, no, I came to your house about 8 years ago, and you wore silk pajamas and offered me a drink and rubbed my knee. And I could tell that his producer felt incredibly uncomfortable. And he was kind of taken aback and just said, he kind of like moved on from the conversation, like he just didn't want to address it, which to me became very clear in that moment that it wasn't his first time, that he had been doing this. And maybe, you know, I think maybe other women had called him out. And so his way of handling it was to just kind of like talk over it about the project. And it was unfortunately not the moment that I so wanted. There was absolutely no reward in that moment for me. I'd heard this repeatedly in hearing other women's stories. And that is the unfortunate thing about sexual harassment. You never get that moment where you feel like the tables are reversed and now he's finally getting it. And the closest we've ever gotten to it is seeing people like Roger Ailes or Harvey Weinstein, seeing some real consequences. I've never seen that in my entire career. This is really the first moment in my life where I see that maybe there can be real consequences for people with these actions.
You are obviously still not divulging the name of the director, which I understand, but tell us in your words why you're not disclosing who it was.
So I actually did disclose his name.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, you don't know that because every time I disclosed his name, the journalist made the decision to not write his name.
Oh.
And it goes to show just how deeply systemic this problem is. I remember the first time somebody asked me about if I ever had a casting couch experience, and I openly shared the experience and named him. And the person decided to not write his name. So the story is out. And strangely, when the Harvey Weinstein story broke, I, for the first time ever, Googled this story. And the story came up everywhere. It popped up everywhere. And nowhere could you find this guy's name. And it was incredibly upsetting to me. And I'm conflicted in the sense that I know that if I said his name again while I'm promoting this film, that it would take over the importance of the story, and that would become the story. And I think there will be a time and a place where I will definitely share this. Again, the way I have always been honest about it, I don't have a desire to protect him, but I also don't want him to overshadow this film right now. And so there will be a right time where I will talk about this again, and I will say his name, yes.
Understood. Was that incident that you mentioned with the director the only time you faced sexual harassment in the movie industry? To the extent that you're comfortable talking about this.
Yes, I mean, what I love about this story of what happened at Fox, and also I think now that we're hearing so many other stories through the Harvey Weinstein of it all, and I think the nuance of sexual harassment and this wide spectrum, that it lives in this gray area, that it's not black and white, it's not always physical assault, it's not always rape, that there's a psychological damage that happens for women in the everyday casualness of language, touch, or threat of losing your job. Those things I've definitely encountered, but nothing physical. That first one was physical, but I've never experienced anything like that. But I have definitely found myself in meetings laughing really loud at some guy's joke to make him feel good, and maybe having a feeling of, I might actually lose my job if I don't do what is kind of being dictated here. Mm-hmm. And it is important for us to, if we want to rectify this issue, to really understand that we have to look at all of the nuance of it, that sometimes victims go back to the perpetrator, that there can be an email exchange that is really friendly, that we have to understand why victims behave this way, or because I think the outside opinion is if you do that, then obviously there is no sexual harassment. And it's in the complications. This is complicated, messy stuff. We have to be able to get into the nuance of it until, if we're really going to get to the crux of the problem.
You sound to me like you do not have an accent. You sound like you were born in America. You grew up in South Africa on a farm. Describe the farm for us.
Well, it's what we call in South Africa a small holding. And so it was around, I think, 25, 30 acres. My parents bought the land because they had a road construction company and they needed the land for all the machinery, all the graders and rollers. So we lived off the land, but it wasn't an agricultural farm, but we survived off that farm. I mean, my mom once a year would slaughter a cow, and we would fill four freezers with that meat, and that was what we lived off, and all of our vegetables and fruit came from what we grew on the land. And so I had that kind of earthy experience while my parents ran this business, this road construction business.
So you grew up during the apartheid era.
Yeah.
Were you exposed to black people during that era? I mean, it was apartheid. I don't know if you even came in contact with people who weren't white.
So on our farm, all of the workers, everybody who worked in the company, and it was a pretty substantial company, all lived on the farm. So my whole childhood, I was raised with Khoisas and Zulus and South Sotus and all different cultures. Their children were raised with me on the property, and I considered them my family. I didn't really, you know, there was some isolation in the sense that we weren't really around in a lot of the big cities, that I really understood fully what was going on as a child, as a young child. The information that I really got about what was happening came from my parents. This was conversation that was always kind of whispered around when you went to the neighbor's house. People were always talking about politics, about elections, about all of these issues. So I had that awareness, but I lived in an environment where that wasn't how my family treated any of those people. I slept with a lot of those families. They babysat for my mom. If they went out somewhere, I would stay with them. And so it was only until I was 12 that I or 13 that I went to an art school in Johannesburg, where I really got to witness firsthand absolutely the atrocities of apartheid.
What were you taught about race in school?
Oh, history was leaning very much into our white history. The heroes of our story of our founding fathers were all white. And, even though very much like I find our culture, this climate that we're in right now, with our polarizing political views in this country, it was very similar in South Africa. I had friends who had family whose father would be for apartheid. And once they found out that, you know, black people lived on our farm, wouldn't let me come over for sleepover. And so there was a distinction in that not everybody was living this way, but that it was very much thought of as, people felt very strongly about it, and then other people didn't feel and thought that there was a reason to fight this. You know, I always wonder what my life would have been like if I grew up in one of those families. If I was just an innocent child who was born into the family who, like one of my friends, who believed that apartheid was the right way of life. I was just incredibly blessed that I was raised by, you know, especially my mother, who I was really kind of raised by a single parent. My father wasn't around that much, but by a mother who was just aghast by all of this. I didn't really truly understood, I think, what any of this really did to me as a young child until I was in my mid-30s and I went to therapy for the first time because of a relationship that was failing. And what I discovered while in therapy trying to save my relationship was that I had a lot of trauma from being a young child growing up in South Africa during the apartheid era.
And can you tell us more about the trauma for you? And what you figured out later about how you as a white person, as an empowered person, were traumatized by apartheid.
That's a lot to reconcile with when you realize that you benefited under a administration, a nation, a country, because you had the right skin color. I benefited. My life was more comfortable because of the suffering of a lot of people who just by chance were born in the wrong skin color. And that is a lot. That was a lot for me to carry. It still is. It is. I think it's something that I'll carry for the rest of my life.
So this is another South Africa question. You know, during the last years of apartheid, there was a cultural boycott. You know, a lot of performers weren't going. There were a lot of like recordings and books that weren't available, either because of the boycott against apartheid or because the government didn't allow it in, because they were afraid that, as all authoritarian governments are afraid, that it will open people's minds and that will work against the authoritarian government.
Yeah.
What were some of the things that you did not have access to, either because of the boycott or because of the government?
I had never seen a live performance. Like I'd never gone to see a rock concert or a musician play live until I was living in Europe. I was 16 and I went to my first concert. Nobody really came to perform in South Africa when I was in my teenage years. I remember vividly a teacher sneaking us in into a room and showing us 20 minutes of Stanley Kubrick's 2001.
Okay.
And I remember I was 14 years old and all of us, our minds were just blown. I mean, we had film, but it definitely we didn't have access to everything. And I remember that for some weird reason, that film was something that everybody was talking about. And I have still, to this day, I don't know how this teacher got access to the 20 minutes that he shared with us. But I just remembered in that moment, and then obviously later when I left and actually watched the full film, that depriving people from simple things like this, that feeling inferior, that there's somehow this danger that, you know, a film could like make you feel. And by the way, that it could. Yes, I do believe that like a great art can change people, but it was so sad.
How old were you when you left, and why did you decide to leave then?
I left 3 weeks after I turned 16. I won this modeling contest, and one of the prizes was a trip to Italy, to with a modeling contract. And my mom was just incredibly encouraging of me going. She felt like it was a great opportunity for not only, you know, the possibility of, you know, finding maybe something that would interest me, or a life abroad, or being able to, like, travel, even if it was just, I had never been on a plane. I had never seen anywhere. We had never traveled before. We drove, you know, to Durban in our car for 6 hours every holiday. So I think there was this moment that coincided with the political turmoil at the time. This was in 91. She said, you should really take this opportunity. And that's why I left. I felt really bad. My father had passed away just a few weeks earlier. And I didn't want to leave her alone. She was going through a lot. And she really kind of like pushed me out of the nest. And she said, you have to take this opportunity. It was an incredible selfless moment that she gave me as a mother.
Charlize Theron speaking with Terry Gross last year. She stars in the new Netflix movie The Old Guard, playing the leader of a small band of immortal warriors. After a break, we'll continue their conversation, and we'll hear from another formidable movie figure, actor Danny Trejo, the subject of a new documentary called Inmate Number One, The Rise of Danny Trejo.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Going Through It, a MailChimp original podcast hosted by Tracy Clayton. Tracy speaks with 14 notable black women, including Josie Duffy Rice, Ilhan Omar, Lena Waithe, Angela Davis, and more, discussing a pivotal moment when they decided it was time to make a change. Subscribe and listen on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's conversation from last year with actress Charlize Theron. She stars in the new Netflix movie The Old Guard, playing the leader of a group of immortal soldiers. When they left off, they were talking about Theron leaving South Africa at the age of 16, shortly after her father's death.
You mentioned your father passed away. This is a part of the story that I know you don't, I think you might not want to talk about, so I'll just mention what happened, and you can tell me if you'd like to talk about it or if you'd prefer not to. Your father came home drunk one night and shot at you and your mother. She got her gun and shot and killed him, and that's how he died. I don't know if you're comfortable talking about that or
yeah.
Not.
Okay. No, yeah, no. I am. I think a lot of my any reluctancy that anybody has ever heard is just that this is usually the headline that people walk away from. And I think what's frustrating is that the trauma around having an experience like that, of course, is quite surreal. And but it's more the fact that. You know, my father was a very sick man. My father was an alcoholic all my life. I only knew him one way, and that was as an alcoholic. And South Africa at that time was not necessarily a place where there was any, that you didn't have access to any kind of support group where you could even acknowledge that this was a problem or go and find help. Our culture at the time was very much that of like, well, this is what men do. Men drink. And the day-to-day unpredictability of living with an addict is what is, I think, the thing that you sit with and have kind of embedded in your body for the rest of your life, more than just this one event of, you know, what happened one night. My father was so drunk that he shouldn't have been able to walk when he came into the house with a gun. And he shot through my mom and I. We're in my bedroom leaning against the door because we thought he was trying to push through the door. And so both of us were leaning against the door from the inside to have him not be able to push through. And he took a step back and just shot through the door three times. And none of those bullets ever hit us, which is just a miracle. But in self-defense, she ended the threat. And this is a story that I have, you know, shared with a lot of people. And so I'm not ashamed to talk about it, because I do think that the more we talk about these things, the more we realize we are not alone in any of it. I think for me, it's just always been that the story really is about like growing up with addicts, like and what mm-hmm. that does to a person. Mm-hmm.
Did you think that you and or your mother would die?
That night? Yes. No. I really believe that was it. Yes.
So what do you do after a shooting like that? Did you call the police?
Your body goes into automatic in a strange way. I just remember my mom saying, "You have to run to the neighbors. You have to run to the neighbors." And I was in my pajamas. I was barefoot, and I just remember I just ran in complete darkness, and I could hear my breath. I just remember my breath felt so amplified in my ears as my feet were hitting the dirt road as I was trying to get to the neighbor's house. But I think she wanted to get me out of the house. I think she was still in that moment. She was being a mother, and she was trying to get me out of the house. And, you know, I felt like I left her in the threat, that she was still in danger. Mm-hmm. But the neighbors kept me at their house, and our neighbor and his son ran over, and they were with her, and I only came over, she came to get me about an hour later. And up until that point, I didn't know that he was dead. I had no idea that he was dead. And so it wasn't, you know, I think that was, you just kind of like find yourself in this like continuous motion of shock.
Mm-hmm. How do you mourn your father when your father tried to kill you and your mother? I mean, what is that mourning process like? Did you feel any grief?
You know, for me, it was a long one. My mom was incredibly strong, because that's just kind of the person. She just has a quality about her where she is. I feel like she knew that she had to be that for both of us, but she didn't deny me the room to mourn. And I remember one night we were staying with my aunt, and I was in the bath. And she was just sitting with me on the side of the bath, and I started getting really emotional. But I didn't want to show her because I didn't want her to feel bad. And I just remember her saying to me, "It's okay, it's okay." And so, you know, I think we did what we had to do, and she allowed me to kind of grieve in a different way than she was grieving. And she, I think for her, she was stuck in the consequences of that night for another 3 years of her life, because there was a lot of unfortunate things that happened after that that she was still in the middle of. And
legal things, or?
Yeah, yeah. And
I should mention, she was acquitted on self-defense, so.
Yes, yeah.
I'm thinking about how strong your mother was, that she, you know, because you just told her she encouraged you to leave after you won the modeling competition, and to go to Italy, and to be abroad, and maybe stay abroad. And considering what she was going through after that, that just seems like so strong of her, and so protective of you, and showing such love for you.
It's incredible. You know, now that I have my own two daughters, and I just even trying to wrap my head around that idea of what she did with my own kids, it's tremendous what my mother did. And the gift that she gave me, I've said this a million times, I would not be here today if it wasn't for her selfless decision to really push me out of that nest and say, go, you have to take advantage of this.
Well, she prevented you from being the daughter of the woman who shot her father.
Yeah, I mean, she is very
much... Because no one would know when you went to Italy. No one needed to know about that.
Nobody knew. Nobody knew for really, I mean... Nobody knew until somebody found the story. I for years just never shared the story with anybody.
When did your mother move to the U.S.?
Well, she would always come and visit, but she she's been living here full time for the last 14 years, 15 years.
You're very close now.
Yeah, physically and emotionally. Yes, I mean, she lives like 2 minutes away from me. And she co-parents with me, and she's a huge part of raising my girls. And, you know, it's she is just a really cool person. If she wasn't my mother, I would still be this close to her. Like, I just think that she is so, like, she is like no one I have ever met in my entire life. She is a broad. She is a lover of life. She appreciates things on a level that is just so lovely to be around. You know, she wakes up every morning at 5 a.m. and she hikes for 3 miles with not only her dogs, but my dogs, and will send me every morning a photo of the sun coming up.
And, that's so great.
You know, and yeah. That really sums up who my mom is.
Well, Charlize Theron, I have to say, you have really led an eventful life. What a life.
I've been very fortunate, very fortunate.
I want to thank you for sharing some of your life with us. Thank you so much for coming to our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Charlize Theron speaking to Terry Gross last year. The actress currently is starring in the new Netflix movie, The Old Guard, playing the leader of a group of immortal soldiers. After a break, actor Danny Trejo, who's the subject of a new documentary about his unusual path from prison to Hollywood. This is Fresh Air.
What do you do when you have too many pickles in Alaska and not enough pancake syrup in New Jersey? On the next episode of Planet Money's Summer School, we send supply and demand to the rescue. It's the economics education you always wanted but never got around to. Every Wednesday, listen now to Planet Money from NPR.
Before Danny Trejo became an actor, he was an inmate, in and out of California jails, including San Quentin and Folsom Prison, for more than a decade on charges related to drugs and robbery. His unusual story is told in the new documentary Inmate Number One, The Rise of Danny Trejo, which tells of Trejo's path from prison to Hollywood.
My career took off immediately. It was almost like doing porn. Every time I walked onto a set, the first thing the director would say, take off your shirt, Dad, because they wanted to see that tattoo. This girl was interviewing me, and she said, aren't you afraid of being typecast? I said, what are you talking about? She said, well, Danny, you're always playing the mean Chicano dude with tattoos. I thought about it. I said, I am the mean Chicano dude with tattoos. So it's like somebody finally got it right.
You never went to acting school or any of
Well, I trained at San Quentin Drama Arts.
Yeah.
Since landing his first movie roles in the 1980s, Danny Trejo has never lacked for movie or television work. Right now, during the pandemic, he has 24 films that are awaiting release, in post-production, or in some state of filming. The character Machete, the tough guy Mexican Federale in the Spy Kids movies, was written specifically for Trejo, who went on to star in 2 Machete action films. On TV, he's made guest appearances on everything from Desperate Housewives and Baywatch to Sons of Anarchy and Breaking Bad, where he showed up in 2 episodes, playing a Mexican cartel drug runner named Tortuga who was being interrogated by the DEA. Interrogated, but not intimidated.
Hey, white boy. Better learn Espanol, huh? This ain't Branson, Missouri. You know what I'm talking about? You know what? I'll teach you. Vamos a hacer un negocio. It means, let's make a deal.
That character arc didn't end well. Tortuga was decapitated with his head mounted on a living tortoise. Danny Trejo, however, has thrived, and now his story is being told in the new documentary about his life. Terry Gross spoke with Danny Trejo in 2018.
Danny Trejo, welcome to Fresh Air. In movie roles, you're famous for being really tough and very menacing when you need to be.
Yeah.
Was that an asset for you in prison? Was that something
Absolutely.
You knew how to use when you were in prison?
Absolutely. There's 2 types of people in prison. There's predator and prey. You have to decide every day which you're going to be. And it's that simple.
So how did you turn yourself into a convincing predator so that you wouldn't be prey?
Have you ever seen me?
Yes, I have. That's a good answer.
That's how I got in the movies. You know? but you go to prison the first time because now it's so easy to go to prison your first time arrested.
And so now when you go to prison, all of a sudden you have not been brought up in this lifestyle. So if you were in juvenile hall, in youth authority, and then in prison, that means you went to prep school, you went to graduate school, now you're in the university, and you know how to behave. You know what to do, what not to do. If you're there for the first time, you're walking around asking, can you help me? Hey, buddy, could you tell me where the pool is? You know, so it's like all of a sudden you're lost. You're not in your element.
So you came up through the system, so you knew,
yeah.
You know what to do. Okay, so something that really helped you in your later life as an actor, it helped get you into acting, is that you became a lightweight and welterweight champion in prison.
Yeah,
so
boxing. My uncle started boxing in golden gloves, and I was his sparring partner, a punching bag. And so I either had to learn how to fight or get my head kicked in, and he... You know, he taught me how to fight. So basically, anything you're good at, you can use. Like some people are real good at writing letters. Well, that's a way to protect yourself. Some people are real good at fighting. That's, you know, boxing, I think, kept me out of a lot of trouble.
Why do you think you were able to give up drugs and stay out of prison eventually? Like, how old were you when that happened? And what was... What was the turning point for you?
Cinco de Mayo, 1968. Me, Ray Pacheco, Henry Quijada, I can say that because I think they were both killed in robberies. We were involved in a prison riot, went to the hole, and expected to go to the gas chamber.
What were you accused of?
Inciting a riot. And by the grace of God, I can remember saying, God, if you're there, if you let me die with some dignity, I will say your name every day, and I will do whatever I can to help my fellow man. And really, I thought it was just going to be a couple years, then they were going to kill me, but it wasn't. It's like he fooled me and gave me the rest of my life.
Was it hard to learn kind of emotional control, like controlling anger and things like that, coming of age in prison?
Anger is probably something you don't have in prison. You don't have anger. You can't afford to get mad. If it is worth your time, then you go directly to rage. You understand?
Wow, okay, yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, I can remember, it's like, I've watched attorneys argue, and I'm waiting for somebody to get socked. You know, wait a minute, you get a sock him? You know, and because in prison, you don't get angry. You know, you go directly to rage, whatever it is, because that's your defense. The bottom line to an argument is a murder. So if you say something to me that I think is an attack or belittling, I have to think, is this worth killing him over?
It's quite an equation to have to go through all the time.
Well, it only takes a split second.
So when you got out of prison, you couldn't go from zero to rage.
No.
Because, you know, murder isn't the bottom line when you're, it's not the way to settle an argument when you're out of prison. Rage is not, you know, it's not always the most effective way of going about things, particularly out of prison. Mm-hmm. So how did you learn how to control that?
I think I had a really good support system around me. And, you know, I mean, that's the main thing coming out of a prison. It's like, if you're by yourself, then you're still alone. And it's like, I had a great support system, which was the 12-step program. And the people that I was around knew about rage. They knew about the bottom line to an argument, it's a murder. So I was just real choosy about the people I associated with. I honestly believe that if you come out of prison, you need a support group and not a parole officer.
So... I'm interested in hearing your story about how you went from coming of age in prison to then being, you know, getting out, eventually becoming a youth drug counselor, work that you're still doing, and having a movie career. I mean, it's not like you were studying acting while you were in prison.
Well, you know, it's funny, but when people say, where did you study? I always think standing on the yard in San Quentin, knowing that there's a riot coming, you're absolutely scared to death with every fiber of your body. You know, I might get killed right now. And you have to, like, pretend you're not. You know, you have to stand there and make everybody think you like it. You know, you can't even sweat. It's like you're standing there, you just got this smirk on your face like, yeah, yeah, we're going to do it now. Oh, yeah. And people around you see that and go, yeah, yeah. And then you just build everybody up. And all of a sudden, there's no fear. It's all rage. And you know, 10, 15 people in rage is a really powerful force.
So you're saying you did learn how to act in prison.
That's, yeah, how to act not afraid.
Right, right. So you didn't need to study the method or Stanislavski or anything.
No,
to,
yeah, I always joke about my acting coach, Juan Strasberg. You know what? You're the only one that's ever laughed at that. When I always say my acting coach, Juan Strasberg, people think, oh, is that a...
Is that a person?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's great. So let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Danny Trejo. We'll be right back after a break. This is Fresh Air.
What do you do when you have too many pickles in Alaska and not enough pancake syrup in New Jersey? On the next episode of Planet Money's Summer School, we send supply and demand to the rescue. It's the economics education you always wanted but never got around to. Every Wednesday. Listen now to Planet Money from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from WHYY, presenting the podcast Eleanor Amplified, an adventure series kids love. Hear reporter Eleanor outwit crafty villains and solve mysteries as she travels the globe to get the big story. Available where you get podcasts or at WHYY.org.
This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Danny Trejo, an actor, a drug counselor, and somebody who spent his formative years in prison. And on screen, he's played a lot of very, very tough people, including in movies like Machete and Desperado, and in the TV series Breaking Bad and Sons of Anarchy.
Spy Kids.
Spy Kids, that's right. So tell us the story of how you were first cast in a movie.
Okay. The way I got into the movie business, you know, running around trying to be an extra. They used to give you $50 for being an extra. I ran into a good friend of mine, a guy named Eddie Bunker, who was a great writer. And people don't know it. Eddie actually got famous because he could write writs in prison. That's one of the reasons why the Department of Corrections hated him.
Oh, W-R-I-T-S. Like
writs, you know, a writ to get you out of prison.
Oh, okay.
Like a writ of habeas corpus. He would charge people, and he would get their documents, and he'd look at them, and he'd go, hey, wait a minute, hold right here. They violated your blah, 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 blah. And he would write a writ. Now, a writ has to be grammatically correct. It has to be written in the language of the court. So basically, they stacked the deck against you because nobody knows that stuff but attorneys. But Eddie knew how to do it. So people would pay him, he'd write a writ, you'd come back to court. And he got a lot of people out of prison. I've known him for years. And then when I ran into him on a movie called Runaway Train with John Voight and Eric Roberts, he asked me if I was still boxing because he had saw me win the lightweight and welterweight title up in San Quentin. And I was lightweight and welterweight title of every institution I was in. And that was my uncle teaching me how to box. And so he said, are you still boxing? And I said, Eddie, I'm 40 years old. I don't get hit in the face anymore. I train. I'm in shape. And he says, we need somebody to train one of the actors how to box. And I said, what's it pay? And he said, $320 a day. And I said, how bad you want this guy beat up? You know, because $320 a day, that was more money I was making a week. And I was a drug counselor, right? And he goes, no, you have to be real careful, Danny. This actor's real high strung. He might sock you. I said, Eddie, for $320 a day, give him a stick. Are you crazy? I've been beat up for free, Holmes. And I started training Eric Roberts how to box.
How did he do?
He can't fight. And then Andre Kajalowski, had Eric.
He was the director of the film.
Yeah, Andrei Kozlovsky was the director. Very soft-spoken Russian. Beautiful man. Beautiful man. I mean, he was like, he wore those funny sweaters with the leather on the you know, on the elbows.
Oh, the elbow patches.
And cardigan, and just was real, always had these sweaters on, and just soft-spoken. And he didn't understand. Eric was a movie star. Okay, now movie stars yell and scream and walk to their trailers and stuff. You know what I mean? So Andrei couldn't really understand what was, you know, because like I said, you don't do that in Russia. And so when he saw Eric was listening to me as far as boxing and stuff, he came over, Andrei comes over and says, you be in movie, you fight Eric, and you be my friend. I'll never forget that. And you be my friend. Now, if you have a prison background, you don't like people to say, you be my friend. You know, because you just, yeah, no, yeah, you'll be my friend. And so, I'll never forget. Then he leans over and he kisses me on one cheek, kisses me on the other cheek, and then he walks away. I told Eddie Bunker, Eddie, I'm going to train that kid for $320 a day, but if I'm going to be kissing that old man, I want more money. And I'll never forget, they had somebody cast. And I remember Andrei going, no, 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 look. And he went to Eric's face and he goes, ah. And then he went to this other guy they had cast who looked a little like Antonio Banderas. Goes, ah. And then he came to me and went, look. Contrast. He kept saying contrast. I didn't know if he was like making fun of me or not, but he wanted contrast. So I got the job.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Actor Danny Trejo speaking to Terry Gross in 2018. Earlier this month, a documentary premiered about his life in Hollywood and his life before that in and out of prison. It's called Inmate Number One, The Rise of Danny Trejo. On Monday's show, our guest will be British writer and actor Michaela Cole. Her HBO series I May Destroy You is a fictionalized account of a sexual assault she experienced after her drink was spiked, and what it's like to experience flashbacks of an event you can't remember. Cole is the daughter of immigrants from Ghana and is a former born-again Christian. I hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with help from Mike Villers and additional engineering support by Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Thea Challoner, and Seth Kelly. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Incouli.